pleasure to welcome back Dr. Sokolow for what's going to be five parts. So we finished with the Haftarah. We finished our Tanakh. That's it. Now we're moving on to new areas. No Tanakh. Haftarah is also part of Tanakh. So now we'll discuss for the next 5 weeks, please God, the philosophy of mitzvot. I think that's what we called it and meant as, I think, Tameh HaMitzvot. I think that's what you said you want to focus on. And yes, Yom HaTzimut should be the fifth of Iyar. I don't want to get the whole thing. I think this is actually beautiful. Beautiful. The quote-unquote secular government of Israel makes Yom HaTzimut on the 5th of Iyar, because on the 4th of Iyar this year, because it would be on the 5th of Iyar, be on Friday, and it would lead to extra Chol HaShabbos. It's such a beautiful thing about so many beautiful things that, you know, the Gemara says, Afilu Rekanim Sheba Mileim Mitzvot Krimon. Even the empty ones of Israel are full of mitzvot, like the seeds of a pomegranate. And, you know, believe me, the vast majority of quote-unquote secular Israelis are very far from being, you know, secular. Half of non-observant Israelis keep kosher. It's a whole different world. So, yes, it is the 4th of Iyar only, but that's when we celebrate. Okay, that's enough of me. Nobody came here for this. If you want to come to hear me, you can come to my class on the Siddur at 9:35 on Friday morning. And with that, Dr. Sokolow, it's all yours. And you can open to discussion if you'd like, as we sort of intimated before, and I'll let you handle it. Vakasha.
Thank you. There's no more perfect segue into the philosophies of mitzvot than your citation of Malei Mitzvot Kerimon. Everybody knows that a rimon has 613 seeds.
Right, except it doesn't. Except for the fact that it doesn't, we all know that. Correct.
Well, that's okay, because now we have the ceiling of Lincoln Square Synagogue, which has 613 light bulbs in it.
Is that really true? Is that
for the... I never counted them, but that's what it says in the brochure.
Cool. Yes. Okay. Next time,
aren't they all working?
Actually, I wanted to start a pool to identify each one of the light bulbs with a particular mitzvah, and the pool would be which one would burn out first. Okay. Anyway, I actually do have a little Dvar Torah for Yom HaTzimut, and I'll save it for a little later. Okay. So, here we go. Okay. So, philosophies of mitzvot and rationales of mitzvot can either be entirely synonymous, or if they're not entirely synonymous, they can be at least correlated with each other. It really depends upon whether you're looking at individual mitzvot. And if you look at individual mitzvot, then what you're actually seeking are rationales. Whereas if you look at the entire network of mitzvot, at the entire system of mitzvot, then you're looking more for a philosophy than you are for a rationale. And we will talk both about mitzvot at large, philosophically, as well as looking at individual mitzvot and attempting to establish their rationales. And in doing so, I'm going to rely primarily on two books, and I thought no better way than to just simply introduce them to you. The one on the left is a translation from the Hebrew original. The Hebrew original is called Tameh HaMitzvot B'Sifrut Yisrael. And the English translation, as you see, is called The Reasons for the Commandments in Jewish Thought, From the Bible to the Renaissance. And the author was Yitzchak Heinemann, an outstanding scholar, particularly of Midrash and of Agadah, of the early to mid-20th century. The other book that we'll look at is actually entitled A Philosophy of Mitzvot, and its author was Rabbi Dr. Gershon Appel. Full disclosure, he was my uncle. That certainly explains why, of the two titles, I chose philosophy rather than reasons. But here, just to be fair, and if you can access the PowerPoint presentation, you can read these. I'm not going to spend the time on it now. This is part of the introduction the translator's introduction to Yitzchak Hanuman's book on the reasons for the commandments. And following it is part of the introduction to Rabbi Appel's philosophy of mitzvot. So if you want to get better acquainted with the books themselves, then this is the way to do it. The only thing that I do want to pull out of here, of the slide on the translator's introduction to Heinemann's book, is the second paragraph. He notes in the first paragraph that Heinemann discovered or identified a threefold classification of mitzvot. This would be philosophical rather than rationale, right? One is intellectual, right? That the purpose of mitzvot is to enlighten us. The other is practical, that the purpose of mitzvot is to enable us to do things correctly. And the third is emotional, that the purpose of mitzvot is to give us something with which we identify as Jews. Either way, he says, there are different kinds of reasons because there are different kinds of human beings in a religious community. Some are driven by the desire to understand, intellectuals, some by emotional involvement, right? And some by the joy of practical participation. Okay? It is the nature of religious observances to be complex and multifaceted in order to satisfy different people in different ways. Thus, he says, all these categories of reason, all these different philosophies, will have some validity in explaining the value of the religious observance for different kinds of people. So in essence, in seeking the philosophies of mitzvot or the rationales of individual mitzvot, there really is something for everybody. Pretty much, there's very little unanimity, either amongst scholars of the classical era, scholars of the Middle Ages, or even of modern and contemporary scholars, when it comes to the reasons for different mitzvot. And indeed, there are usually enough different opinions on the subject for everybody to find something with which they can personally identify. And hopefully that's what we're going to be able to discover together over the next several weeks. Okay. So I want to start with the Torah itself. And we note that the Torah itself offers reasons for some commandments, and we'll look at several specific ones this evening. But in general, it emphasizes the wisdom of the law. That would be what Heinemann would have called the intellectual philosophical approach to mitzvot at large. Also bear in mind that the Torah appears to distinguish between different categories of mitzvot, referring to one as mishpatim. And the fact that I put the word ordinances after it doesn't mean that that's the only way in which to translate it, okay? And the other category are chukim, statutes, without, however, itself offering any clear principle of division between them. So that, of course, as we can now anticipate, is something that the Talmud will begin to address. So let's look at several biblical verses that introduce us to the subject of mitzvot at large. And here we have one from nearly the tail end of the Torah, from the 30th of 34 chapters in the book of Devarim, the chapter that describes a ceremony called Hakhel, in which the entire Jewish people, men, women, and children, would gather together and they would listen to the reading of the Torah or perhaps a discourse on Torah matters, delivered by no less an authority than the king himself. And it's pretty much in this context, meaning the people being addressed here are not any particular social stratum, nor any particular gender audience. These psukim are addressed to the entire collective body of the Jewish people. So much so, and that it's even formulated in the grammatical singular. as though God were speaking, as it were, or Moshe was speaking, as it were, to each and every individual Jew directly. And it says, Ki tishma b'kol Hashem Elohecha lishmor mitzvotav v'chukotav haktuva b'sefer haTorah hazeh, right, that if you will obey, if you will listen to the voice of the Lord your God, and you will observe his mitzvot, his ordinances, and his chukim, his statutes, haktuva b'sefer haTorah hazeh, that are written in this Torah book that Moshe had just completed, and that he would entrust to Yahushua and to the elders to continue to teach from it to the Jewish people. Ki tashuv el Hashem Elohecha b'chol levavecha u'v'chol nafshecha. And this obedience to the law comes hand in hand with a return to God, that if indeed the Jewish people are at one with God, is actually a little play on words there, right? At one. At one actually happens to be the etymology of the word atone. On Yom HaKippurim, when we seek atonement, we are actually seeking to be at one with God. So this Tashuv el Hashem Elohecha, this return to God, this being at one with God, goes hand in hand with the observance of the laws of the Torah. And then in the next several psukim, Moses, again, speaking for God and addressing the Jewish people, basically his valedictory address, tells them about these mitzvot. And he says, HaMitzvah hazot, notice again, it's in the grammatical singular. He's not talking about any individual mitzvah. He's talking about mitzvot as a concept. And he says about mitzvah as a concept, lo nifleitim mimacha velo rechokahi. Neither is it too hard for you to observe, nor is it too distant from you to observe. Okay? If we reverse the negative into a positive, okay? Moses is reassuring the Jewish people that the mitzvah, that the mitzvot are within their capability to observe, and that they will have adequate opportunities to observe them as well. Then he continues again in this hyperbolic rhetorical fashion, and he says, "Lo b'shamayim hi," right? That the key to understanding mitzvot is not secreted away in heaven, as though somebody would actually have to be able to ascend to heaven in order to discover the secret of mitzvot and bring it back to earth. Again, reading it in the positive, it's right here on earth with you. Lo me'ever layam hi. And then you might say, okay, so it's on earth, but I don't see it. It must be somewhere across the ocean. That is to say, too far away for me to actually understand or appreciate it. No, again, he says, it's lo me'ever hayam. It's not to be found at some distant point across the ocean, as though somebody would have to cross the ocean in order to discover again the secret of mitzvot and bring it back to the land of Israel. Rather, in the final pasuk, he says, ki karov elecha hadavar ma'od. Not only is it close to you, not only is it nearby, but it's karov ma'od. It's very close to you. How close indeed, he says, v'ficha uvilavavacha la'asoto. It's as though you could actually, I don't know, taste it, or you could feel it. Meaning, Moshe is basically telling the Jewish people that the mitzvot of the Torah are not some esoteric thing that only a few select individuals are able to understand, but rather he's telling them that mitzvot, again, mitzvot writ large, are something that are accessible to each and every one of them. I highlighted b'ficha uvil vavacha la'asoto in a different color for something to match it with an upcoming slide. Now, again, we saw that it says, there's a reference there to both mitzvot and chukim. And here, we have again another reference to Chukim u'Mishpatim. And as you see in the text on the lower half of the screen, again, there's this this combination of Chok u'Mishpat. Okay? The verse on top, again, from the beginning of Sefer Devarim, Moses says to the Jewish people, Re'eh, look, he says, Limadati etchem chukim u'mishpatim, I have instructed you in the chukim, the statutes, in the mishpatim, the ordinances, kasher tzivani Hashem Elohai, just as God instructed me to do. And the reason that I have taught you them is la'asot kein, so that you should be able to perform these chukim u'mishpatim, b'kerev ha'aretz asher atem ba'im sham al rishtap, in the midst of the land which you are going to enter and which you are going to inherit. And he tells them, ushmartem, that you should observe the mitzvot, va'asitem, not only observe them to be conscious of them intellectually, but to actually practice them. Why? Ki hi chochmatchem uvinatchem le'enei ha'amim. Because these mitzvot distinguish the Jewish people in the eyes of the nations of the world as being both wise and comprehensible. So again, we get some clue. The mitzvot of the Torah are not esoteric. They're neither in heaven nor across the ocean, but they are nearby. Every individual has the capacity to understand the mitzvot and to perform them, and that through every individual's understanding of the mitzvot and their performance, it creates an image of Judaism as being a religion that is both wise and comprehensible. So it says that these nations, asher yishma'un et kol ha'chukim ha'ela, when the nations of the world hear of all of these laws, va'amru, what are they going to say? They're going to say, wow, rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh, that this nation of Israel must be a truly wise and understanding people. So we get some indication again about the purpose of mitzvot, the purpose of mitzvot again, using Heinemann's categories of the intellectual and the practical and the emotional. The Torah seems to come out, to the extent that it does at all, in favor of the intellectual. Mitzvot are to be comprehended, understood, right? Chochmatchem uvinatchem. And that through the understanding and through the performance of mitzvot, the Jewish people and the Jewish religion acquire a reputation of being wise and understanding. As for the distinction between chok and mishpat, that becomes a very important distinction, first in Talmudic literature, but later even more so in medieval philosophical literature. The question is really whether they are to be understood as two different things, or whether they're to be understood as an hendiadys. Hendiadys is a Greek word borrowed by English, and as you see the definition here, courtesy of Rabbi Google, it is the expression of a single idea by two words connected with a conjunction and. And they give you the example of nice and warm, when one could be used to modify the other. It's not that it's either nice or warm, right? But it's nice and warm, so that the equivalent of nice and warm, as though they were two different things, is effectively nicely warm, which is really only one thing, warmth modified by the adjective nicely. We have several such examples of hendiadys in biblical Hebrew. Perhaps the best known one is ger v'toshav. If you look at it objectively, ger and toshav are opposites, right? A ger is a stranger, a toshav is a resident. So when Abraham, for example, says, introduces himself to the people of Hebron, when he wants to purchase a burial plot for Sarah, and he says, ger v'toshav anochi imachem, is he giving them a choice? Is he saying I could either be a ger or I could be a toshav? Not so. Ger v'toshav is an hendayadis, means that it's a way of expressing an idea as though you were saying my status among you is actually neither the equivalent of your own, right? I'm not a full-fledged resident in that respect, but on the other hand, neither am I a total stranger. So I'm kind of like a resident stranger, meaning I live among you, but let's say I don't have my citizenship papers yet. That would be an example of a ger v'tosha. So indeed, it's very likely, looking at it from the perspective of pshat, that chok u'mishpat are hendayadis. It's not the two separate things, chukim being one category and mishpatim being another, but rather it's chok u'mishpat, one or the other, a combination of the two. Nevertheless, that's not the approach that Chazal take, and there's no better way of demonstrating it through the commentary of Rashi, which is basically a citation here from the Midrash, from the early Tanaitic Midrash, in which he illustrates the chukim and mishpatim by the examples of Shabbat, Para Aduma, Kibud Avaim, and Dinim. Now, these are not all alike, as we will come to see in the continuation. Kibud Avaim, honoring one's parents, is not a uniquely Jewish law. Okay? Respect for parents is something that is expected of people in just about every civilization, if indeed it wants to call itself civilized. Okay? Dinim, maintenance of civil order, okay, is also not, as a matter of fact, dinim is considered by the rabbis to be one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, one of the seven Noahide laws. No better indication of the fact that it's not uniquely Jewish than to say that it was assigned to humanity even before there were Jews in the world. Okay. On the other hand, Shabbat and Para Aduma are arguably uniquely Jewish. Certainly Para Aduma, the red heifer, is uniquely Jewish. Okay. And even Shabbat is, because again, some anticipating something that we will look at in greater detail later on, even if you were to argue that a day of rest is a perfectly logical and natural social phenomenon, right? Nobody can work 24/7, 365. Okay. Everybody has to have time off. Okay. So even if you consider the idea of time off from work as being like Kibud Avaim, like Dinim, as something that is universal, the fact that we should take off one day out of every seven is not so. Furthermore, that it should always be the same day in every week, and that it should be the seventh day of every week, that even till this very day still remains, if not uniquely Jewish, certainly typically Jewish. Okay? All right. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I highlighted the Ficha uvilvavcha la'asoto, okay, in the verse from Devarim, in order to introduce this commentary of Ibn Ezra, which again, although Rashi and Ibn Ezra really don't belong in this evening's class chronologically, it's just simply to you know, get us accustomed to what we're going to be seeing later. Ibn Ezra says, Shekol ha-mitzvot, that all of mitzvot, or if you wish, each and every individual mitzvah, ikaram ha-lev, the core of all the mitzvot is the lev. Okay? You notice that I haven't translated it yet. I only transliterated it. Explain in a moment. V'yesh mehem, of all these mitzvot, okay, there are some, zecher bafe, that we are instructed to articulate. Why? L'chizuk halev. Because our oral expression, our articulation, reinforces the lev. And v'yesh, and there are yet other mitzvot, ma'aseh, that require not just an articulation, but actually require some sort of physical activity. Why? Sheyizkor bapeh, to give expression, to give a physical expression to what we are articulating. Big question, of course, is what is lave? Now, even though the lave, right, anatomically is the heart, when the word lave is used in the Torah, and for that matter, almost throughout the entire Tanakh, it seems to be referring not to what we call the heart as the seat of human emotion, but rather it's referring to what we call the brain as the seat of human intellect. The brain as an organ of the body was not known in the biblical period. Okay. As a matter of fact, a hint to that is that the Hebrew word for brain is moach. If you look up the word moach in a dictionary, it'll say marrow. Because originally, all the brain was the marrow of the skull. Okay? Its function, right, in terms of the neurons and in terms of everything else, that function came much later in history. And in fact, the organ of the body that is identified in Tanakh with emotion is actually the organ which is the largest internal organ. And because it's the largest internal organ and the heaviest, it was called the, you get it? Kaved, the liver, from which we get the abstract concept of kavod, being dignified or honorable. Okay? So it is basically the kavod, the kaved, that is the seat of emotion, and the lave was believed to be the seat of the intellect. So I believe that what Ibn Ezra is saying is that the core of all the mitzvot is intellectual, and that would fit with what we've been saying earlier this evening in terms of the Torah's presentation of mitzvot. But that Ibn Ezra adds that there are some mitzvot that, in addition to their intellectual component, also have some sort of oral component, right? Some sort of speech that accompanies them, right? Maybe like kiddush, right? Zachoret Yom HaShabbat LeKadosho. How do we fulfill the mitzvah of sanctifying the Shabbat day? By reciting kiddush. So kiddush would be what Ibn Ezra says, Zecher Bafeh, right? It would be an articulation, L'chizuk HaLev, because that gives us an opportunity to think about the purpose of Shabbat. V'yesh ma'aseh, while other mitzvah, tefillin, okay? Lulav and etrog, require a ma'aseh, not just an articulation, but they actually require some sort of physical activity, right? And again, for the sense of reinforcement. Here is just a almost random selection of mitzvot in the Torah, a very small minority of the mitzvot in the Torah that are actually accompanied by some kind of rationale. Okay? Starting in Parshat Mishpatim with laws that pertain to pawns, right? Not pawns of a chess game, but pawns of a pawn shop. Okay? Im chavol tachbol salmat re'echa, if you take your neighbor's garment as a pawn, as collateral, at bo hashemesh shivenu lo, you have to return it to him by nightfall. Why? Ki hi chsuto levada hisim lato leoro bameyishkav. Because if in fact that is his nightgown and he has nothing else to sleep in, right? Then you can't deprive him of that, because if you deprive him of that, he will be distressed. Vayaki it's akelai, and if in his distress he calls out to God, God says v'sham marati, I will take action. Why ki chanon ani? Because indeed that is the aspect of God, whether it's graciousness or whether it's something similar that I will take towards this situation. So again, why is it prohibited to keep an article of clothing as a collateral overnight? because it may be that the poor person needs it to sleep in. Continue again in Parshat Mishpatim, the ger lo tilchatz, that you should not oppress a ger. We already mentioned that a ger is a stranger, a foreigner. Why? Va'atem yeda'atem et nefesh ager. The reason is because you, the Jewish people, should be well acquainted. You should be able to empathize with strangers. Ki gerim heyitem bi'eretz Mitzrayim, because you yourself were once strangers in the land of Egypt. I also, if you look at the highlighting, the word ki, right, because, clearly introduces an explanatory reason. But notice that frequently, rather than the word ki, the Torah uses other terms. It may use a vav, usually a simple conjunction. But here the vav, the atem, is not just and you know, but it's really a vav as for you know, because you know. Same thing in the next one, which is part of the instructions to a king. A king may not keep too many horses, because horses apparently were traded in Egypt, and God didn't want the Jewish people dependent upon Egypt. And he similarly is not allowed to take too many wives, because the wives would influence or sway his judgment. And the third reason, the third prohibition, is that he should not amass too great of a treasury, right? Again, for the reason that it should not contribute to a false sense of pride or arrogance. Notice again, the vav's introducing clauses of explanation. And the final example, that Ammonites and Moabites should not be accepted into the Jewish community. Why? Al devar, on account of the fact that when you were trying to cross their territory on your way into the land of Israel, and you ask for permission to cross, and you ask them to just simply provide you with water for the journey, they refused to provide you with any provisions. No bread, no water. They wouldn't even let you cross their territory. And not only did they not provide for you, but they went out of their way to hire a soothsayer named Bilaam in order to curse the Jewish people. So this simply, as I said, not entirely random, but a reasonably representative selection of mitzvot, individual mitzvot, for which the Torah itself provides a reason. We move now into the realm of Talmud and Midrash, and we find, obviously, much more formal discussions of the question, not only of the distinction between chukim and mishpatim, but the reasons behind mitzvot in general. And we see here in the Gemara in Masechet Yoma, Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught us, et mishpatai ta'asu, right? That's one part of the verse. And then it says, v'chukotai tishmoro. So notice that the verse addresses both mishpatim and chukim, okay? And the Talmud says, what did the rabbis teach us? What are mishpatim? They are devarim she'ilmalei nichtevu, that even if they had not been written in the Torah, din hu she'yikatvu, it would be as though they were written anyway. Meaning, they are so self-understood and self-explanatory that even if they had not been part of Torah legislation, the Jewish people would have adopted them anyway. What are these examples of these mishpatim? Idolatry, incest or adultery, murder, robbery, and blasphemy. Which means that these were considered to be things that are in every society, every civilization. Okay, at least some form of formal religious institution. Obviously, the pagan societies in which the Jews found themselves from time to time did not prohibit idolatry, but even if they didn't prohibit idolatry, if people worship more than one deity, there was still some formalized worship, even in Greece and in Rome. Okay, and obviously, laws to maintain the integrity of the family, laws to maintain the integrity of human life, and laws to maintain the integrity of human property, are commonplaces in every organized society and in every civilization. And these, the Gemara contrasts with chukim. How does it define chukim? Dvarim shehasatan ve'umot ha'olam mishivim aleihem. These are things that either Satan, the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, or Umot HaOlam, Gentile nations, Mishivim Aleihem, that they take exception to it. They push back against them, meaning they don't see them as they see things like murder and robbery. They don't see these things as necessary components of a society or a civilization. And what are the examples of that? Achilat chazir. Different societies have dietary rules, okay? Jews are not the only ones to have dietary laws, okay? Nevertheless, the prohibition specifically against chazir, right? Somehow, at least in the Greco-Roman era, which is obviously the background for the Talmud, in the Greco-Roman era was particularly perplexing. Okay? You may remember that one of the legends of the Hanukkah story has to do with bringing a pig into the temple. So obviously, this revulsion to swine and swine flesh struck some sort of discordant chord amongst non-Jews. Levishat sha'atnez. You can wear a woolen garment, you can wear a linen garment. Why in the world can't you wear a garment that's woven of both linen and wool? No sense. Okay? Chalitzat yevama. The laws that pertain to a woman whose husband died and is left childless and then has to marry one of the brothers of the deceased. Taharat mitzora, the purification of a leper. Sa'ira mishtaleach, the ritual of the scapegoat, which we read just last Shabbat in the Torah reading. B'shema tomar, and then the Talmud again, to make its moral lesson more blatant, says, B'shema tomar, perhaps you might think, ma'asei tohu heim, that indeed, the second category of laws, right? The achilat chazir, etc., they really are totally arbitrary. Talmud lomar, no. The Torah says, ani Hashem, right? This week's Sidrav Kedoshim, right? Almost every verse ends the same way. Ishimo v'aviv tira'u, honor your father and mother, ani Hashem, right? V'ahavtal re'acha kamocha, ani Hashem. Okay, the attachment of ani Hashem to the mitzvot is to say ani Hashem chekaktiv. God is the legislator. Ve'en lecha reshut leharher bahen. And since God legislated it, you have no right to reject it, or even for that matter, to criticize it. So again, bear in mind this distinction. Talmudic distinction between mishpatim that are at least arguably reasonable, logical laws that will be adopted by every organized society and civilization, and those other, the second category, things that are not just distinctively Jewish, but that seem at least on the surface to lack the same conviction, the same convincing social logic that other mitzvot have. And again, the Tanaitic Midrash, going back again to the entire verse that we just dissected, Ushmartem et kol chukotai that kol mishpatai vasitem otam. Notice that in addition to the words chok and mishpat being highlighted, so are the verbs Ushmartem and vasitem, which arguably could mean two different things. Lishmor is to observe. Okay? La'asot is to perform. You can observe something without performing it. Okay? Yet, the Midrash says that the reason that the Torah used both of these verbs is litain shmira va'asiyah, to apply both observance and performance lechukim ulemishpatim, equally to both those things that appear to be logical and that I would say, oh, I would do them anyway, as well as to those that I wouldn't do if the Torah hadn't specifically ordered me to do it. And again, going back to the verse and to the concluding phrase, Ani Hashem, the Midrash interprets it to mean, Ani ne'eman l'shalem sachar, meaning, if you ask yourself, what advantage accrues to me, or if you wish, what is my reward for honoring my parents, or for enforcing laws against robbery, the answer is obvious. You will be respected by your children, and your own wealth will be regarded and safe and kept safe from others. But if you were to ask yourself, what benefit accrues to me, or in other words, what is my reward for any of the other rituals that are mentioned there, the answer is there is no reward, because basically you're not doing anything. You're abstaining from doing something. You're not wearing a garment that has mixed wool and linen. So you're not doing anything. So what benefit accrues to you from that abstinence? Ani ne'eman l'shalem sachar. Don't worry, God will be able to deliver your reward. We're going to end this evening, not ending yet, don't worry, we've got a little while to go, but with several selections from one significant Talmudic passage. It appears at the very end of the Tractate of Makot. And it is the foundation stone, so to speak, of the entire enterprise of seeking philosophies or rationales for mitzvot. This is the first and pretty much the only time in rabbinic literature that we are told that there are 613 mitzvot. And it's taken for granted. Rabbi Simlai, when he preached, would say 613 mitzvot were communicated to Moses, of which 365 are lo ta'aseh, lavin, negative precepts, don't. Right? Don't. And they correspond to the number of days in a solar year. And the remaining 248 are positive precepts, mitzvot aseh, things that we are obliged to do. Okay, and that corresponds to the number of evarim, of organs or limbs of a person's body. And again, this is a theoretical number. So the 365, obviously, is not a random number, okay, because there are 365 days in a solar year, okay? But the idea that there are 245 parts of a human body is reasonably a random assertion. What they basically did is they subtracted 365 from 613, and that was the remainder, okay? Now, as I said, Rabbi Simlai stipulates this, okay? He himself does not give any source or authority for his statement, okay? Which would seem to imply that it was so well known that it required nothing more than his assertion. Rabbi Simlai would get up and he would start off by saying there are 613 mitzvot, and people wouldn't jump up and say, you're sure it's not 612? Sure, it's not 614. How do you know? Right? It would seem to be sufficiently well accepted that everybody in the audience would simply nod their heads and wait for Rabbi Simlai to move on. Rabbi Hamnuna asked the question that we would have liked to ask Rabbi Simlai, and that is Mikra. Do you have some sort of scriptural basis for this assertion that there are 613 mitzvot? And the answer that he gives is a verse, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, that Moses instructed us in Torah. Torah, begematria, shitma'a v'chadsre. The numerical value of the letters that make up the word Torah is 611, right? Tav is 400, resh is 200, that's 600, vav is 6, and five is hey is 5 is 11, 611. So if we read that verse alphanumerically, it says that Moses gave us 611 mitzvot. Okay, we're still shy two. So what are the remaining two? Anochi v'lo yihyelecha, the first two of the so-called Ten Commandments. We didn't have to wait for Moses to instruct us in them. Mipi hagivu rashma anum, God himself proclaimed them. This is part of a midrash, which is also very suitable for the holiday of Shavuot, that says that God began to address the Jewish people in the first person. You can tell that grammatically, because the first one of, again, the so-called Ten Commandments is Anochi Hashem Elohecha, I. The second one is Lo Yihyelecha Elohim Acherim Al Panai, right? My face. Whereas from the third one on, Lo Tisa Et Shem Hashem Elohecha Lashab, that already speaks of God in the grammatical third person. So a midrashic way of accounting for the fact that the first two Dibrot are spoken in the first person, and from the third one on, it speaks of God in the third person, is that the Jewish people were so frightened by hearing God's voice that they turned to Moses and they said to Moses, we can't take this. So God, you know, stopped proclaiming the mitzvot himself and left the balance of the Ten Commandments to be proclaimed by Moses. So again, if you take the verse Torah Tzivalanu Moshe alphanumerically, and that, of course, again, is just an hypothesis, okay, then you get 611. And if you add to that the two mitzvot that weren't taught by Moses but were taught by God himself, it's a way, again, of supporting the notion that there are 613 mitzvot. The balance of this passage is fascinating from, again, the perspective of the philosophy of mitzvot. Because what it begins to do is to say, 611? No. But David v'hemidan alachat esrei. David came along and he basically reduced the 613 mitzvot to a mere 11. And the citation of a verse in the book of Psalms, right, which asks rhetorically, who is a righteous man? Meaning, who can dwell in God's temple? And it enumerates the characteristics of a righteous man, and there are 11 such characteristics. So in other words, David is not saying that we don't have to wear tefillin anymore. You know that one of the favorite Agadic renditions of David is that David wore tefillin all the time. Okay. So it's not that David denied the validity of the mitzvah of tefillin, but David was basically saying that the purpose that is to be accomplished by the total performance of as many mitzvot as are incumbent upon any individual to observe is to produce a person who has these 11 qualities. By Yeshayahu v'midan al-shesh, and you think that David reduced it to 11, Isaiah was able to reduce it to 6. And then Micha came and reduced them to 3. And then Isaiah once again came and reduced it even further to 2. And eventually Amos came and reduced them to a single principle, right? And eventually the Gemara comes to the conclusion, the last two lines in the Hebrew, Ba Chavakuk ve'emidan alacha, that the prophet Chavakuk came and he basically reduced the complexities of 613 individual mitzvot into the tzaddik ve'emunato yichye, that the essence of life for a righteous person is to make sure that everything that he does and everything that he says or everything that he abstains from doing or fails to say should be a reflection of his faith in God. And this is reflected as well in a much better known text. Famous story about the prospective convert who comes first to Shammai and then goes to Hillel. And he asks, Tlamdeni kol ha-Torah kula kshani omed al regel acha. I will convert to Judaism on condition that you teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Shammai, as we all know the story, chased him away. What did Hillel say to him? The alach sanei, that which is despicable or hateful to you, l'chavrach la ta'aved, don't do it to someone else. could be the Aramaic equivalent of love your neighbor as yourself. It could be the ancient Aramaic equivalent of Kant's categorical imperative. But in any event, he reduces the totality of Torah observance to one specific thing, right? Don't do unto others what you would not want others to do unto you. V'idach, everything else, he says, perushahu, is merely commentary, zil gemor, go learn the commentary. I wanted to end very quickly with a Dvar Torah for Yom HaAtzmaut. In my synagogue, not only do we recite the prayer for the welfare of the state of Israel every Shabbat, but we actually, it's not just read by the Gabbai as though it were a Mishaberach L'choleh, it's recited by the entire congregation. I can go around checking to see who says it and doesn't, but anyone who wants to, and many people do, recite it aloud together with the Chazan. So it becomes a real tefillah rather than a Mishaberach. There's a line at the very beginning, which is very controversial. The line says, Barech ad Medinat Yisrael, we ask God to bless the state of Israel, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, the first flourishing of our redemption. And there are many people who look at the state of Israel and say, Israel's a good thing. It's nice to have a haven from persecution. You know, it's nice that they have, you know, that whatever it is, but it's not our, show me how we're being redeemed. So there are people who either skip that line, or there are people who emend it, okay? When Rabbi Riskin was the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, he insisted that they should amend the text, and they said, bless the state of Israel, shetehe reshit smichat gulatenu, that it may sometime in the future become the first flourishing of our redemption. I want to say a word about the word flourishing, smicha, because it ties into something else that is a mitzvah taseh shazman grama, a time-bound mitzvah. And that is the Gemara and the Halakha that's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, that during the season of Nisan, if you see a fruit tree blossoming, there's a special bracha that you recite over it. Right? Shelo chiser ba'olam ochlum, that God didn't leave out anything of aesthetic value in the world. Ubararo briot tovod ve'ilanot tovim lehanot bahem bnei adam, that God provided things for man's aesthetic satisfaction. And flourishing, blossoming trees, the Gemara tells us, Ein lecha keitz megule mizeh. When the trees in the land of Israel start bearing fruit, the Talmud tells us that is the surest sign of the impending redemption of the Jewish people. And there's an interesting halacha that applies to the recitation of this bracha. And that is that the bracha can only be recited when the tree is in the stage of budding, of blossoming. Once the fruits appear, the halacha says, it's too late to make the bracha. I think that the connection is somewhat obvious. To make a bracha over fruit is to make a bracha over that which already is. To make a bracha over the appearance of blossoms, which herald the eventual arrival of fruit, is to put your trust and faith in God, that God, as nature, will deliver the fruit. People who can't find it in themselves to see in the state of Israel the first flourishing of our redemption are missing an opportunity to make a bracha. Because once the redemption becomes as patent, as obvious, as the fruits on the tree, it'll be too late to make a bracha over it. They'll enjoy the fruits, but they'll miss out on a wonderful opportunity to make a bracha. And with that, I wish everyone mo'adim l'simcha v'ligu'ula shelema. We should rejoice on this, and may we all be able to enjoy the ge'ula shelema b'meirah b'yameinu.
Thank you. Thank you. So, you know, of course, we're already at the stage. A few people start pointing out maybe we're beyond Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. Maybe we're Be'emtza Geulatenu. Let's hope, you know, Reshit was 74 years ago. But, I mean, obviously we don't know these things. And I remember being at Yeshiva University and Dr. Lamb, who, you know, I've been the rabbi at the Jewish Center. He, one Shabbos, he spoke about why he doesn't say Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, also Shetehei, because he, you know, messianism is a very dangerous field. But it's interesting in the, you know, in the, I don't know how many people here have read how tradition just put out a, just a few months ago, a fantastic, I don't know, 300-page volume, a tribute to Dr. Lam. They had about 25 different people writing articles of different aspects of Dr. Lam. So they, I think they do it in alphabetical order. So the first person is Ari Berman, who also serves as rabbi of the Jewish Center, and also, of course, today.
I want to begin by thanking our host.
Okay, I don't know where that comes from. But anyways, that he said, Ari Berman has the opening article. He explains that when he came to the Jewish Center, you can read a whole interesting discussion about what he should do, because Dr. Lam had done one thing and J.J. Schechter did another thing, I believe, and how, you know, what, how the Tfilah L'Shalom HaMedina, the British version is very different. But anyways, I agree with the sentiment, just pointing that out. It's an interesting idea, where at least in Reshit Smicha Kulateinu, let's hope we're well beyond Reshit Smicha Kulateinu. And like you say, Mo'adim L'Simcha L'Gula Shleima, and everybody should say whatever we everybody should recognize in their own way. Tomorrow on Torah in Motion Zoom channel at 1:15 p.m. I know it's a little bit of a strange time, but that's okay. 1:15 p.m. Rabbi Alan Schwartz will be giving a shiur on Yechezkel's dry bones in Yirmiyahu, Modern Messages of Independence. That's more at 1:15. And then at 8:30, our regular course Parshat Shavua shiur. 9:35 a.m. My sitter shiur on Friday, Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday, and Root with Simi Peters on Monday, along with Mark Shapiro at night. And we look forward to seeing you. Okay, everybody, and please invite a friend, and everybody be well. Laila Tov, and we should hear good news. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thank you.
And I was still in college or maybe just in graduate school, I attended a Yavne Shabbaton on the Upper West Side.
Uh-huh.
And okay. I was asked to daven Musaf in the Jewish Center.
Uh-huh.
And I just simply recited the Tfilah L'Shalom HaMedina, not ever imagining that there was a modern Orthodox synagogue that didn't say it. And when it was over, a couple of guys in top hats and morning coats came over to me and kind of told me that if we were back in the Hasmonean days, I would have been pelted with etrogim for it.
I think they always said it. My understanding is they always said it. I know J.J. Schechter tells a story. The first weekend he was there, and Norman Lam is davening in the shul. He's not the rabbi anymore. And they hand him a version of Tfilah L'Shalom HaMedina, and it's not what he's used to. It's not Reshit Smicha Kulateinu, and he didn't know what to do. And I think he went over to Dr. Lam, and Dr. Lam said, you're the rabbi. We will, whatever you do, I will support you. And because I think Dr. Lam, I think he said it, but okay, obviously there must have been a time in history it was not said. But I think today, I know I don't recall being to a shul that I heard them say Shetei Reshetei. I mean, how many shuls have we done in that? I'm sure 100 shuls over the years, you know, on Shabbos morning, maybe more. I've occasionally been to a shul where they don't say Tfilah L'Shalom HaMedina, unfortunately. But whenever they say it, I've always only heard the version of Avinu Shevashmaim Tzuri Yisrael V'Golo B'Rechem Medinat Yisrael Reshit Smichat Kulateinu. I don't know. Have other people heard other versions often? Does anybody in your shul say different versions? It's interesting. You know, of course, there's a whole history. We should have a shiur. Debbie, what do they say in your shul?
I think in B'nai Yisurin they say the other one.
Because, okay, Rabbi, what's his name? Did things his
Rizansky.
Own. He celebrated Yom HaTzmut on Hei Iyar, by the way. I assume tomorrow in Bnei Shurun is Yom HaTzmut. And Rabbi Frizansky, because my aunt and uncle, my wife's aunt and uncle, daven there. So I know when Rabbi Frizansky celebrated the Yom HaTzmut on Hei Iyar. He didn't care what they did in Israel, like iPad wants us to do. The problem with that is I mentioned it when, okay, it's okay this year. It's not so bad. You want to celebrate on Friday. I mean, I think it's, if you ask me personally, it's silly. The Jewish people are celebrating it tomorrow, but no. But the problem is when it's a mukdam. You know, in the years when Yom HaZikaron is supposed to be on Sunday and they push it off to Monday because they don't want any Chiluk Shabbos starting on Saturday night. So then you end up doing Hey Iyar becomes Yom HaZikaron and Vav Iyar becomes Yom HaTzmut. And then you end up saying Hallel in America when people in Israel are mourning for the people who are fallen, and that's disgraceful. And if I can use such a word, I know that's harsh, but you know, how can you say halal here when people in Israel are mourning for their dead? So whatever, but yeah, each to each his own. But I imagine this year with the new rabbi, they went back. I don't know. You let me know when they say halal in Bnei Yeshurun. That's kind of interesting, but I was going to say, oh yeah, there is of course a whole history. Maybe we should give a shir one time. We should get somebody who composed the song, you know, who composed the Vina Shemaim. You know, the rumor is, or more than a rumor, that it was really Shai Agnon. That Rav Herzog, you don't agree, Rabbi Sokolov? Rav Herzog turned to Shai Agnon. No,
actually, this it's a chapter in my next book that'll be out hopefully by this.
Well, season. I haven't read it yet. You didn't send it to me. How do you expect me to know?
I'm delighted to send it to you. The ultimate proof that Agnon had nothing to do with it is that he never laid claim to it.
Why are there persistent, you know, rumors that Agnon did compose it?
There are people who just simply thought that it was his style, who did not like the two chief rabbis who actually wrote it, and thought that would undermine their prestige and their authority. But Agnon wasn't shy. And if Agnon had anything to do with it, we would know.
Okay. I assume you, I don't know, did you ever meet Agnon? Died when? In 71, 72? When did Agnon die?
When I was in Karmel Yavna, I just spent...
right. So there, okay. I never met him, but all right. But so what, Rav Herzog was the one who composed it? Is that
your... And the Rav Uziel. I believe.
Along with Rav Uziel. Okay. Along with Ben Sion Uziel.
Yes. I was very surprised about it an hour ago. I was at a Zoom for the Hagigi in Riverdale.
Uh-huh.
And they said the whole filler and then the corn filler, but they did not say halal.
Yeah, saying halal at night is, I don't know. I'm not a big fan. Everybody should do what they feel is right. I'm telling you too. I find it strange to say halal at night. I even find it strange on Pesach night when they say it in shul. I grew up, we didn't say halal at night. I don't walk out of shul. I don't think it's respectful to walk out of shul. So I sit in shul and I hum and I sing to myself.
But I don't know. I've never seen it before. So it was strange to me. I was waiting for halal and it wasn't that.
Yeah, listen, I don't know. I don't know how many people say halal at night. They have the Tfilah Hagigid and half of Lechadodi and Kabbalah Shabbos, whatever. So, all right, it depends. I guess I didn't go tonight. I was debating whether to go. They haven't gone as far as whatever. I didn't go. Obviously, I'm here. But what they do in Toronto normally is they don't say halal. Or they, listen, the last 2 years, obviously, we haven't had it. But 3 years ago, and I go most years, they do not say halal. They say Kabbalah Shabbos, not parts of Kabbalah Shabbos, parts of the Chodod, Dodi. They blow shofar. Do they make a Shechiyano? I don't think so. I don't remember now. But they have whatever. You know what? It's too early. The Gemara by Hanukkah says, L'shana Acheret Kiva'um L'halav Oda. We're too soon to know. Over time, there'll be a consensus, right? Tomorrow morning, I know in chat where I'm going to daven our school, we will say the extra psukim, at least unless they changed in the last 2 years, but they've always done the extra, they say the Shabbos psukim zimra, and we say the Haftorah, Oro Yom Benov Lamod, the Haftorah from the last day of Pesach, which is never said. They read the Haftorah without the bracha. That's sort of a strange thing. That's the only time of the year we read the Haftorah and don't make a bracha. So, I think the minhag in chat is they don't make a bracha on halal. No, whatever, each to his own. But
when I was a kid in Bnei Akiva, we used to go, we had in Borough Park, we had the largest sniff of Bnei Akiva in the country.
Not anymore.
and yet, on Yom HaAtzmaut, we would all schlep on the train to Washington Heights for the Tfilah HaGigit. And I always wondered
where in the Heights. Where in the Heights did they have it? What shul in the Heights?
It was in the Yeshivas Reb Moshe Soloveitchik.
Uh huh.
On 185th Street.
Okay.
Yeah. And when I finally got to the point that I asked somebody, why are we schlepping up here? I got my answer. The answer was to accommodate Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who insisted on getting maftir. Since he lived up in the Heights when he was teaching at YU. So as an accommodation to him, Bnei Akiva from all over the city came to Washington Heights, so there would be a minyan at which he could read the Haftarah.
I found that very strange. Rav Lichtenstein had no interest in kavod, whatever. So I don't know why he wanted
kavod. It was.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't kavod.
The person I asked who explained it to me was the Talmai Madrich in Bnei Akiva, Benji Tabori.
My Rosh Hashiva in Toronto in Archaim. Yes, a great, great person, unfortunately, no longer with us. But yes. So, yes. Oh, Rav Tavori was your Madrich in Bnei Akiva?
When I was a teenager, the minyan I attended on Shabbat was in the furnished basement of his parents' home.
Well, he lived part of his life in Baltimore. Wasn't his father rabbi in Baltimore?
If it was before the 1960s. It could be, okay. I don't know. But from my teenage years, the Minyan of Bnei Akiva in Borough Park was in the basement of the Tabori home.
Very interesting. Very cool. All right, Borough Park, you was a different place back then. Like, okay. All right, anybody else have Yom HaTzmut stories they wanted to tell Bnei Akiva as you grew growing up, you know, like... Rav Soloveitchik, of course, delivered his famous drasha, Akodo Dido Fake, in 1956 on Yom HaTzma'ut. And, you know, it's, that's the, if you haven't read Kodo Dido Fake, please do so tonight. We'll give you a test on it before Shir tomorrow at 1:15. It's in English. Okay. We'll give you an extra day to read it or so. It's really a phenomenal piece. That's, I guess, the original Zionist manifesto of religious Zionism. Okay. People don't leave, you know, they listen to us talk and banter back and forth.
No.
Laila Tov. Okay. Tomorrow, everybody. And like I mentioned, the Almonds are sponsoring the Shir tomorrow by Rabbi Schwartz. And, we look forward to seeing you 1:15, and we look forward to seeing you at many of our upcoming Shirim, you and their friends who you invite to come and join us. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Sameach.